Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded Plus podcast. This week my guest is Professor Heidi Norman of the University of Technology in Sydney. Professor Norman is a leading scholar of Aboriginal political history, where she looks at questions of power in relation to Aboriginal citizens, the state and settler society, and Aboriginal land justice. She's also written about the history of the New South Wales annual Aboriginal Rugby League Knockout Carnival, and last month she gave a paper about the long history of Aboriginal players in Australian Rugby League at the Rugby League Reflections Conference in Sydney. So, welcome to the podcast, Heidi.
Hello, Tony. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. It's great to have you on. Well, I'll start with a $64,000 question. How did you get involved in looking at Aboriginal Rugby League history?
Oh, I think there's probably a few things. Three quarters personal and then the rest are sort of academic interest. I think as a rugby league fan, there's quite a phenomenal thing in Australian rugby league, and that is for Aboriginal people we make up maybe 2-3% of the population, but when it comes to rugby league and a few other football codes, you get up to maybe between 15-20%. And that has included the high ranks of national representative side, national coaches, captains, and more recently in commentary. And as the women's participation and the coders become more formally organising around a women's competition, we see incredible participation rates of Aboriginal women. So there's a few reasons, and one is that just to try and understand how it is that are people really who have been very marginal in Australian social society, economy and politics have managed to secure such a strong foothold in this particular code. And, you know, I wanted to think about what that says about race relations at times when we had practices of segregation, separation, marginalisation to the outskirts of certainly in the country towns. These were kind of mandated in certain ways by the state, such as segregated swimming pools and occasionally even towns were segregated. And so at the same time those sort of regimes were in place, you had Aboriginal men who were lauded as stars of the football field. So I wanted to sort of look at that more closely and think about the contradictions and the possibilities around, you know, in that space. And also, like a lot of families, on my mum's side, we have many of our extended family network have played rugby league, and on my father's side as well, the Normans, they've been rugby league players. So it's sort of rugby league is a big part of a lot of Australian family lives, and I wanted to understand it certainly in terms of what it tells us about social and economic relations in Australia.
Yeah, that was quite interesting because, in a sense, although obviously I'm from the north of England, that's one of the reasons why I started to look at the history of rugby league as well, because it was so wound up in history of my family going back generations. One of the points you make in your paper to the Rugby League Reflections Conference was the long history that Aboriginal players had in rugby league going back to the 1920s, and in particular pointed to the example of Jackie Brooks, who you've identified as probably the first publicly recorded Aboriginal rugby league player. What can you tell us about him and his career and what that demonstrated about Australian society in the 1920s?
Yeah, so Jackie Brooks, I really think he's quite a standout character. And whether there are other players, I don't know. But we do, definitely, I'm confident to say, he's the first Aboriginal man we know of playing rugby league. And there's an incredible archive of local newspaper reporting of the game and of his performance. And for the most part, over his career when he started playing for Katoomba, I'll tell you a little bit about Katoomba in a minute, from 1923 through to about 1936, so a pretty long sort of playing career in the amateur and representative ranks. He played from 1923 to 1936, so it's quite a long playing career. And he lived in an area known as the Valley, which was a kind of marginal Aboriginal fringe camp, basically, on the outskirts of the township of Katoomba. And Katoomba is located in the Blue Mountains, north of Sydney, so it's almost a two-hour drive from Sydney. It's a now it's a renowned tourist spot, and it's extensive sort of national parks, and they're blue because of the eucalypt from the gum trees that cover that part of the just west of the city, west of Sydney. So it was also at that time it was quite a significant tourist destination, but it did have an enduring working class settled population. And by the turn of the century, a lot of Aboriginal families were coming in from living on bush locations to more settled village life, if you like, or fringe camps on the borders of the bigger towns. And that was because economies had changed. From the 1890s, there was a drought, there was a depression, so there was a loss of jobs in rural and bush areas. And so you had a lot of Aboriginal families settling in fringe camps, and Jackie Brooks's family was one of those. And the area where they kind of settled and founded was known as the Gully. And to call it a fringe camp probably creates a bit of a wrong visual, because they in fact had a church and quite substantial dwellings and access to a creek, so a sort of reliable water supply. And Jackie Brooks was kind of a remarkable character in the middle of that. So you can imagine a relatively marginal status, but all of the newspaper reports convey this sensation. He played on the wing. I think he was quite slight in his build, and he was super fast. And when he got the ball in his hands, the crowd went wild. They got up on their feet. They cheered. One time he arrived at the game a little late, and in the newspaper report they say as soon as Jackie Brooks took to the field, the crowd was electrified. So his ability to electrify the crowd, to turn a game around. At one other time he fractured ribs, and the ambulance officer tried to get him off the field. He refused. He played on through these broken ribs and continued to sort of, take these crushing tackles. And, you know, he was a kind of hero. I think at one stage there he was best player. He, at the presentation, end of season presentation, he played the gum leaf and the guitar. So he was not only the star player, he was also the star entertainer. So he must have just been this incredibly charismatic man. And to have a black man in the middle of all these white players, and, you know, keeping in mind that at the turn of the century, you know, Australia was committed to a white Australia policy, and that was reflected in all institutions, from the federal government down. And so we had this, you know, this stunning sort of man who worked in the local a local restaurant, very fancy restaurant, that was sort of the site for tourist visitors. In 1927, he took legal action against his boss for unfair payment, which seemed like quite a bold sort of exercise for an Aboriginal man. In many cases, you weren't even counted in national census. You didn't sort of have a place in the national story, and you were still under very controlling special laws for Aboriginal people. So there was an Aborigines Protection Board that kind of controlled your movement and activity. And so even in that history, here's this striking man who's taking action against his boss for unfair wages successfully. And he's written up in the local paper saying the famous rugby league player Jackie Brooks has taken action against his employer, and they were found guilty and had to pay all costs. So he wasn't, you know, I'm sort of suggesting that those kind of examples, he wasn't someone who was a black man passing in a white world. He was quite charismatic. I think he engaged in the world in his own terms. Yeah, he brought home food from the Carrington where he worked through his community, and he fed all the local cats with all leftover food and so forth from the Carrington. So,
was his career restricted in any way by racism, do you think?
It's very hard to know, and I think that's one of the challenges of being a historian of rugby league, is that it's difficult to not see the past through the lens of the present. And what we have are the newspaper stories, and we can sort of read against the grain, read between the lines. There were when he that story I mentioned earlier where he played through with broken ribs. That was the only time he's picked up as an referred to as an abbo, and that it's very offensive today. It might have been absolutely offensive then, but it was the pretty predominant language. So in newspapers as far away as the north coast of New South Wales, they pick up this story about this courageous abbo who plays through with broken ribs and so forth. So I think that's where we get a sense of the peculiarity of this Aboriginal man being, you know, such a figure, such an esteemed figure.
Yeah.
That story that was printed in the local paper where he was from was picked up by several other country papers. He did try out for selection in the countryside. Unsuccessfully, and I'm not sure if that's because he had a poor showing or whether that was a kind of bias on the part of recruitment. It does seem strange that he wasn't picked up, given that what a sensation he was.
I'm thinking of the example of Frank Fisher in Queensland comes to mind. He played Wide Bay against the British tourists in 1936. And he was offered a contract with Salford to come and play in England. And, Frank Fisher is the grandfather of Cathy Freeman. And he was offered a contract to come and play in England, in Salford, in, say, 1936. But the controller of Aborigines, or whatever the title was in Queensland, refused to allow him to leave the state because the excuse was that, well, Aboriginal men have no business going and playing abroad. And so that's an example of how racism simply stops someone's career at its height. And I wonder whether Jackie had suffered anything as explicit as that.
I don't have any evidence of that. I don't know that means it didn't occur, but I don't have any records. I don't have any entries in the Protection Board records to show that there was a direct control over his life. There's a couple of things worth keeping in mind, and that is that the rule over Aboriginal lives, it was state-based, and Queensland, New South Wales was not good, but Queensland was even worse. And so it's likely that the Queensland laws had much greater reach at that time into your life. In 1923, when Jackie Brooks was playing, there was reach in terms of controlling children and the beginning of the removal of children. By the 1950s, for example, there was a policy shift towards assimilation. One of the very sad things is that all of Jackie Brooks' children were removed. They all went into institutions.
Yeah, that was a deliberate policy by the state, wasn't it, to steal children, basically.
To remove children from their family environment and you know, inculcate them into you know, white working class tradition, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he lost all of his children to at the hands of the state.
Yeah, it's unthinkable, isn't it? Unconscionable. Mm. One of the things you went on to talk about in your paper was the growth of Aboriginal teams, not just players, in the 1930s. And you talked about teams like the Moree Boomerangs and the Redfern All Blacks. Can you say a little bit more about how these teams grew up and what obstacles they had to face as well?
I think there was a real tension. So let me just first map out. So at least in the 1930s, there are several all Aboriginal rugby league sites. So the Moree Boomerangs. Moree is a town in northwestern New South Wales. This is plains country. It's where there was in the sort of opening decades of colonisation, extreme violence over land and resources. And so one of the responses after those killing times was to create by the end of the 1800s as missions and reserves. And so in Moree, there were some quite large missions and reserves that formed, and they were all over New South Wales, and those missions or reserves were located nearly always either in some way demarcated from the, you know, white township, so over the other side of the railway tracks, other side of the river or creek. And so you can imagine for players that formed on those missions and reserves, they were affiliated through the mission or reserve. And so the Moree Boomerangs, there were some from the south coast. The Redfern All Blacks were sort of different, and so were La Perouse in that they were city sides.
Yeah.
So they were very much part of an urban sort of industrial city centres, whereas in places like Moree and the Orient Point down on the south coast, they were very much marginal. Aboriginal worlds were marginalised. You might have been pulled in for seasonal work or as shearers or fencing, women as domestics, but for the most part you were marginal. And so, you know, it's quite extraordinary that you had these teams organising and playing and being very successful. And so at times when you were cut out of towns, you were cut out of the swimming pool, even the cemeteries were segregated, you were still engaged in the intimacy of playing rugby league, which, you know, is quite extraordinary. So you would have had all of your family and supporters come into town for the day and be cheering you on from the sideline. So it must have been... we can only take ourselves back there in a kind of creative way to think about how odd that would have been.
Yeah.
And the sort of borders that you're stepping over and that somehow were momentarily sort of released in order to allow rugby league to take place.
Yeah.
I speculate that maybe, sort of almost like a thinking out loud idea that it was also part of a culture of, you know, like a native performance that we might have seen in the circus or in other places, like a sort of exceptionalism. It certainly would have been the case that playing rugby league would have possibly put some money in your pocket. And if you were one of the few players who got picked up by the white sides, then you may have got a bit more money. But was it an opportunity to shine when you had no other avenues to shine? And it certainly wouldn't have been at school or university or et cetera.
Yeah. And one of the other points you mentioned is that in some of this, I think it's largely in the city teams, there were actually mixed race teams as well. Like, didn't the Redfern All Blacks start off as they also had white players initially? And you mentioned, was it a team in Dubbo rail workers?
Yeah, exactly. So the Redfern All Blacks and La Perouse to an extent, and still today, they are still quite proud of being inclusive of people from different races and different ethnicities. I think Redfern All Blacks even had some Irish travellers in their side a couple of seasons back, which they were, you know, they're very chuffed about. And it would have been great for those players to be so much part of a, you know, Aboriginal world. Redfern All Blacks from the 1940s, La Perouse about the same era, maybe a little bit earlier. And in Western New South Wales, there was a railway workers union side, and they were a mixed team. They define themselves as mixed race team. So, yeah, there are these sort of peculiar examples, I think, where certainly, you know, Redfern was an industrial, light manufacturing area. There was plentiful jobs. Many Aboriginal families made their way down. It was also where the first railway was opened up in the colony. And so the travel to and from, it was an easy departure point in terms of travel for work in the industrial area. So it was that the combination of an economy and also with this, you know, you had lots of people, your own people around you, and certainly having the rugby league team made a big difference.
Because I wonder whether to some extent the door in rugby league to Aboriginal players in Australia and also to black players in Britain was always slightly more open than in other sports, because rugby league itself was founded in a kind of opposition to the establishment and a call for equality between, you know, between working class players and middle class players. So I wonder whether there's something in the culture of the game that, whilst it didn't stop it being racist, meant that the culture of the game was slightly more open to non-white players than what other sports at that time would have been.
I think so. I think that Colin Tatts, who's a leading sociologist here, he says rugby league has been kinder to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people than any other sport. Others say similar things. I think the working class basis of rugby league, the fact that it's a low resource intensity game, you know, in the past we've had a lot of commentary, and it certainly was a part of the media, although we didn't see it with Jackie Brooks, where there was attributed like a sort of, an innate quality amongst Aboriginal players. So this blindside flick or these kind of incredible sort of, you know, sacred secret skills that Aboriginal players possess. But I'm more, you know, some of that is very racially inflected. But I'm more inclined, and I think this is what a lot of people have said in my research around the rugby league knockout that formed in 1971, is that rugby league is like a religion. This is what George Rose, he's a former player and now a commentator, is like a religion amongst Aboriginal people. And that's because it's something everyone can play. So you can play in big groups. You can scrunch up newspaper. You can pass anything around that is a substitute for a ball. You can play on a bindi field pitch, you know, with barefoot.
Yeah.
All you need is shorts. And you can slightly modify the game to cater for girls, you know, your aunties, even your nan, boys of different height, sizes and heights. So, and just the thrill of playing, you know, in such big groups that, you know, without necessarily the strict rules about numbers per side. So the fact that it's a game that lends itself to that sort of fluidity and adaptability, and it's low intensive. So one thing you did have growing up Aboriginal is plenty of people around and plenty of space, generally speaking. And so if those were the conditions for rugby league to thrive, it was, it was a perfect environment.
You mentioned the New South Wales Aboriginal Rugby League Knockout Carnival. Can you say a bit more about how that developed? Because I think it started in 1971. What was the background and the context of that?
It's the very existence of this incredible rugby league carnival. So next year we'll be celebrating 50 years. And the very existence of this carnival speaks to that much longer history. And It emerged in the 1970s, 1971, and that some of the parallel events that emerged in Sydney and in Australia were, say, the claim for self-determination. At some stage, the discourse was black power, but more so Aboriginal land rights, the emergence of the Aboriginal Medical Service, Aboriginal Legal Service. So this kind of flourishing of identity-inflected political movement. And where black power was at times a motive, it more shifted to be something that was much more influenced by local conditions and local demands. And so those demands were less civil rights focused and more about Aboriginality as a deep connection to place.
Yeah.
And so this might sound counterintuitive, but an event like the knockout allowed for that connection to place to be sort of reenacted and spoken of. So, for example, it's a knockout carnival. There had been knockout carnivals before 1971, and the men who organised it, they were that first generation. They were sort of in their late teens, maybe in their early 20s. They had relocated to the city, the urban industrial fringe of the city for work and also in search of, you know, like picked up in this what must have been an incredibly exciting political time. And so they moved from rural towns where their work prospects were being a shearer or fencing, and they came to the city and they were in flares and big hair and going off to dances and drinking in pubs and You know, some men were and women were accessing university, and so they talked about this in my work on the knockout and around land rights. People were talking about this decolonization of the self that was taking place, and the ferment of ideas and activism, sometimes accidental, but you know, in organized ways. At the same time, there was a there was a South African tour, so there was an anti-racism, anti-apartheid, that not only was a mobilising presence amongst unions and progressives, but it also drew attention to the sort of segregation and racism in Australia. And so the knockout and those men organising, they were wanting to reproduce the same sort of family networks and intimacy and connection that they had in their home country towns. And some of that was fostered on the missions or reserves and reproduce that in the city. And so they created football teams as a kind of anchor point for belonging and meeting up each week. And like a, you know, they probably didn't use this terminology, but there was a process of identity affirmation that they were seeking. And so today, so they started out back then with five teams competing in 1971, and they came from a few different areas across New South Wales, including the Redfern All Blacks and La Perouse. There was a Western Sydney side, aside from the Central Coast and from far western New South Wales. To today, there are about 135 teams that compete in men, women, juniors, boys, girls. That runs for 4 days. Back then, the prize money was $5 a team, and the winner took the $35. It was only men. Now the prize money is up around $66,000.
And wow, that's massive.
It is a huge event. It runs for 4 days. There are tens of thousands of people each day. It gets bigger and bigger. And now we're looking at, 50-year anniversary of that event, of its continuous running. And some of those sides have competed every single year over the 50 years. And so even though, like that, I mentioned the missions and reserves, so even though they don't exist in the oppressive way they did in the past, but they're reenacted because the young men and women of today want to honour that history. They want to honour that past and the sort of nostalgia for community and belonging and connection. So there's many teams enter the knockout under the nomenclature of the reserves or missions, which is maybe at first glance there's an irony there, because these were sites of containment, and oppressive sort of government regulation of your lives, but they also are reenacted in this very, very loving way.
Yeah, I suppose it's a way of paying tribute to previous generations and the people who helped you get where you are today. Just one final question. Have you any thoughts about the position of Aboriginal players in the game today? Because there's a controversy over, which from a distance seems to be entirely media-driven, over Latrell Mitchell and his relations with the Roosters. And he did an interview on NRL.com earlier this week, which I thought was very interesting, what he had to say about the position of Aboriginal players in the game today.
I referred to Colin Tatts, and Colin Tatts's work has been around race and racism as well as sport. And he highlights that, Australians love sport, and they're also racist. And I am very concerned for the dynamic that we've seen in another code in relation to another player, Adam Goods, and that was with a different code that you'll be more than aware of a similar fate bearing down on the likes of Latrell Mitchell. And I think there is a real contradiction in Australian society where on one hand there is this lauding and loving of the success of Aboriginal men and now women as well in sports, but goodness gracious, there's a very retaliatory sentiment when people don't behave themselves and call into question the nation and call out the sort of settler state dominance. Yes. And I think for players, I'm concerned for players that on one hand they do have a responsibility to engage in politics and stand up for their interests, but I worry about that responsibility when they also are part of a team culture and they have to be looked after because they can become emblematic for conservative media attacking them. So I think there has to be some careful negotiation of how well they're looked after by their teams, and player response when they raise issues of national political interest, and when there's a hostile fan base and hostile media castigate them in that way. So I think it's a very brave situation for young men who are great rugby league players. They're not necessarily well versed in political theory, and they know racism, but they don't necessarily are not necessarily conscious of how the media constructs narratives. So I'm very mindful of
absolutely
how they have to be looked after as they seek to kind of explore these ideas of and their own concerns about racism in Australia.
I couldn't agree more. On that point, we've reached our allotted time, so thanks ever so much. This is absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure listeners will find it equally fascinating as well. I hope everyone out there has enjoyed listening to this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow Heidi on Twitter, her Twitter handle is @Heidi_Norman, and mine is @ColinsTony. If you want to dig a bit deeper into the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.